From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Simon Frith explains why he thinks the rock era is over. Frith is a British rock critic and sociologist who covers the British music scene for The Village Voice. Also today, Octavio Paz discusses the influence of history, revolution, and surrealism on his life's work. Paz is a Mexican poet and essayist and one of Latin America's foremost intellectuals. We welcome New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. as Fresh Air's latest performer-in-residence, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone finds inspiration in the new movie Gorillas in the Mist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The pop music scene is constantly changing, and British writer Simon Frith vigilantly monitors those changes, but he writes from a dual perspective, as rock critic and as academic sociologist. He says musical meaning is not just a matter of sounds and words, but it's also determined by culture and context. Frith covers rock and pop in the context of class, sexuality, and consumer culture. He writes about music as a means of self-expression and as a means of making money, and he points out the inevitable conflicts between the two. Simon Frith writes a column about the British music scene for The Village Voice, and he's been rock critic for the London Sunday Times and The Observer. He directs the Centre for Research in Film, Television, and Music at the Universities of Glasgow and Strathclyde in Scotland. He has two new books, Art into Pop, about the influence of art schools on British bands, and Music for Pleasure, a collection of his essays on the sociology of pop. Being both a rock critic and an academic sociologist may seem like an odd double life, and Simon Frith didn't initially plan to be both.
It was accidental in that I happened to be a graduate student doing sociology at the same time as I started writing about rock, which was my major obsession in my life. And I discovered very early on there are great advantages in doing two things, because it means I didn't have to become the sort of hack that you have to become if you're going to try and make a living out of writing about popular music. But it also meant I didn't have to think that my entire life was bound up with being an academic sociologist. So I actually think it's been good to be able to do both things and have some sort of freedom as a result in each area.
Do you think if you make your living as a pop music critic, you're destined to become a hack?
I think it's incredibly... I mean, I'm talking very much from British experience. Uh-huh. In Britain, it's very hard. I've tried it for a year. I took time off the university to see if I could do it. It is very hard to make enough money to live without finding yourself having to do a certain amount of writing of a sort you wouldn't normally choose to do. And you just have to write too much. I mean, in Britain, this is very clear that you have to write so much you kind of lose a perspective on what it is you're writing about.
Is there something you've learned from a more empirical sociological analysis of rock that challenged popular wisdom or challenged your presumptions?
I suppose one, kind of two halves of that. One is that I was aware as a sociologist that people live by a whole series of myths, and I became very interested in the myths of rock and roll that people live by. So I probably gave me a sort of cynicism, a kind of cynical edge to some of the things that certainly when I was reading other critics. And that's just... That's a particular sort of academic mentality where you always want to sort of see behind what it is people are saying. But I think as a sociologist specifically, I did have a systematic interest in understanding how the industry works and feeling that it was important to get kind of true facts, figures, you know, actually to see what the bottom line was, where the money went to and so on. And I think a lot of rock critics don't have that sort of interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, your new book, Music for Pleasure, starts with a very provocative statement. You write, "I am now quite sure the rock era is over."
Yep.
Why?
Well, obviously, one of the big problems one gets into is deciding what is meant by rock, but I think I meant that an era which is, roughly speaking, from the late 50s to the late 70s, in which people believed that there was a form of popular music that in itself was rebellious, countercultural, carried certain sorts of messages of independence and freedom that made it different from other sorts of popular music, and that was particularly tied up with a certain sort of understanding of youth and youth culture. I think that era is now over in the sense that I don't think there is any music now that can escape from being part of the corporate mainstream. And the pessimistic reading of that is that rock is over. Oh dear, and we should all mourn. The optimistic reading, which is what I have, is it means that we can suddenly become interested in all other forms of popular music as well.
Like what?
Well, in Music for Pleasure, I found myself going back and listening to the sorts of music that was made before rock and roll came along and realizing that people get pleasure out of all sorts of popular music and rock doesn't have unique claims to being specifically radical or the only music that's somehow about the real social world, which is what I think I thought as a rock fan in the late 60s.
Well, if the corporate culture is exerting a lot of control on rock music. Do you think that the music is suffering, or just that the music has a different meaning? I mean, if a rock commercial is if a rock song is used to sell a car, does that mean that the song isn't necessarily as good as it would have been if it weren't used for the commercial?
That's an interesting question. I think it doesn't. But on the other hand, I think once you've heard it on a commercial, it shifts how you hear that song. Mm-hmm. But when you hear Cream's I Feel Free selling Renault cars, it's now part of what that song means. And so it kind of does shifts one's memory of the song, and somehow it makes one more nostalgic for the days when it didn't mean Renault cars. I mean, it's, the advertisers have got something clever going, because partly what they're appealing to is exactly that nostalgia for pre-corporate rock, if you see what I mean.
Uh-huh.
But I think the crucial thing about rock as just another form of popular music, which I've always found most fascinating, is I've always thought pop music only makes sense for its particular moment. It's not like other art forms. You don't necessarily expect that a song is going to go on being valuable forever and ever.
Yeah, but some stuff really holds up so well and ends up becoming valuable forever and ever.
I'm not so sure about that. I don't think there's a single pop... I mean, one of the great things about being a rock critic is you can go on being a rock critic forever, and I don't think you can go on being a rock star forever. I mean, I'm no longer interested in what, say, Bob Dylan puts out. I mean, even though I would be obsessed by him in the late 60s, it's no longer of any interest.
Why?
Because I don't think...
You think he's lost it? Or?
It's more to do... It's not even to do with the individual performer losing it, really. It's to do with... Popular music that matters to me is music which is somehow about the times in which it is being made, has some sort of resonance for the immediate issues. So Tiffany is more significant to me in 1988 than Bob Dylan is, because she's more about what a certain sort of mass culture is like in the late 1980s.
My guest is Simon Frith, and he's both a sociologist and a rock critic who lives in, he's from Britain, and he has two new books out. One, Art into Pop, is about the relationship of art schools and rock in England, and the other, Music for Pleasure, is a collection of his essays. He also writes a column for The Village Voice about the British music scene. You know, there were figures released recently about who in America made more money than anybody else in the past year. And Bruce Springsteen, Madonna, Michael Jackson, we're all the way at the top of that list. When rock stars become as wealthy as popular rock stars have become, do you think it changes the kind of relationship they have with their fans?
Yes and no. I think one of the great... I mean, clearly, Bruce Springsteen is the most interesting of those three, really, because part of his relationship with his fans is based on him not being a multimillionaire and being somehow representative of them. And in that sense, I think... A musician who is powerful enough in musical terms can actually transcend what they are in real terms. I mean, what Springsteen creates a mythical Springsteen, which is what people relate to. And what's interesting in his case is that the myth is the myth of someone who isn't a millionaire. Most pop stars create a myth of someone who is glamorous and rich, and he's the opposite. So I don't actually think my knowledge of how much money he has makes no difference to how I hear his songs. But I think in the long term it becomes something that he as a musician has to start thinking about, and I think that will have an effect on his music.
You know, you were talking a couple of minutes ago about how corporations have taken over rock and roll in many ways. The rock star benefit concerts for things ranging from Amnesty International to freeing Nelson Mandela are usually corporately underwritten. Do you think that these benefit concerts are a sign of rock becoming more political, more responsible to the world around it, or do you see it just as further tie-in to corporate culture in spite of the political theme?
I think it's a sign of rock becoming political in a different sort of way. I mean, its politics is now partly because it has got a certain sort of power, which is kind of global power, a reach that it didn't have before, which means that it can carry certain sorts of messages, in those cases charitable messages, in a way that I don't think probably any other cultural form could at the moment. But that sort of politics is very much politics about making people all feel together, part of some sort of community, a kind of do-gooding community, you might say. It's harder, I think, for rock to actually have a different sort of politics, which is actually what it once upon a time did, which was to stress differences and to say that people were different from each other and this represented a particular interest against other interests. So that the successful charity performances are something like Live Aid, which in a sense it would be difficult for anybody to disagree with giving money to people who are starving. So it's a politics of bringing people together, which clearly does tie in with a certain sort of corporate advertising. I mean, it isn't dissimilar from the way Pepsi-Cola or Coca-Cola themselves sell themselves as a way of bringing the world together because everybody drinks Coke together.
So are you saying that the globalization of rock music is making the music more homogenous?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think in terms of the sort of the core of the music, the sort of the Western Anglo-American form of it, yes, more homogenous. I think what's interesting is it's also going to bring in from the margins other sorts of music that we're not very familiar with, like certain sorts of African music and so on. And those musicians will do interesting things with Western musical forms, which will, you know, which will, may well transform the music.
Videos are also changing the way we hear rock. You write that with videos, the power to define the charts has shifted back to the record companies.
Right.
How do you think that videos is affecting what we hear and how we hear it?
I think it's a very difficult question. You know, there's a lot of argument. One of the standard arguments by rock critics against videos was that you were free when you listened to a song to imagine it any way you wanted. A video kind of fixed the imagination in certain sorts of ways, which I don't think is actually an accurate argument, because I think people are also free to watch a video any way they want in certain sorts of ways. But it's certainly, at the level of individual imagination and the way in which words and pictures go together, I mean, rock has always been a very visual media anyway. There have been pin-ups from the very beginning. Elvis Presley became a star because of television and cinema and so on. I think the difference I was talking about there was more that that form of promotion and selling is both so expensive, which means that the big corporations get great benefits from it, but also it depends on fitting music into television. And television has its own rules, its own particular ways of constructing audiences and so on. And I think it's that, among it, more than anything else, which has helped make rock music a corporate form by pulling it into a much, much more mainstream form of entertainment. And advertisers are interested in rock because it can be shown on television. I mean, they support Live Aid because it's on television. And it's that bringing together of the music industry and the television industry that videos really symbolise. And I think that does shift the way in which rock works in everyday life.
Do you see videos as ads for records?
Yes, that's all they are. I mean, I don't think, in principle, there's no reason why the video form shouldn't become a very interesting artistic medium. But so far, it's almost exclusively been used as ads for records. Or rather, not so much ads for records as ads for stars.
If rock has become more global and more corporate, as you say, is there an underground now, or like an alternate rock scene that you think is vibrant and interesting and different from?
Yes, I think, again, this is speaking from British experience particularly, there's clearly an alternative independent, I mean, what would be called the indie scene, with bands and...
Indie for independent.
Yeah, with bands which very kind of proclaim themselves as being independent from this corporate structure. But in a sense, what they do is they have their own place in that structure. They have a niche there. And in a lot of ways, what happens is that if bands within that structure or within that scene show themselves capable of actually pulling together a big audience, then the corporations move in on them and sign them up. So in some senses, the independents have found themselves in this rather odd position of acting as kind of research and development outposts for the big companies. And I don't think they can really escape from that. I mean, that's the industry is integrated in that sense.
Well, that makes it sound like a certain paradox, that to succeed is to fail, that to be really good and to be noticed spells your ultimate failure, because then you're bought up by the system.
That's right. And it means that what you have is increasing the development of a kind of artistic, an old-fashioned avant-garde tendency within popular music, which is popular musicians who actually want to be unpopular, which sounds like a paradox, but, you know, will deliberately go out of their way not to become part of that mainstream. And I think, you know, one solution to this is a particular sort of artiness, and it's what we were writing about in Art Into Pop, a particular sort of art attitude that has come into rock music in the last, well, very strikingly in the last 10 years.
Do you think that's an interesting attitude, a good attitude?
Yes, I think it's an interesting attitude. It means that, I mean, I think it's in a sense it dissolves, as a lot of other things are dissolving, the traditional distinctions between high culture and low culture. You know, that it is now possible to work in a form which is thought of as popular or mass music, but actually to be making artistic statements and arguments which previously would have been, you know, confined to small galleries or, you know, what were thought of as clearly minority musics.
You're in your late 30s or early 40s?
Early 40s, yeah.
Do you think it's fair to see rock as youth music? You like it a lot, and you're not a youth anymore.
Right. I think certainly in historical terms and the way it originally worked, rock was clearly youth music. And I think one of the reasons why people who get into the middle-aged people go on liking rock is because it's, in some senses, it enables people to retain some sense of youth, some sense of the positive aspects of youthfulness, I mean, even at a fantasy level. And I think in many ways the essence of rock is still to do with being youthful. And one of the interesting questions is to what extent those values can actually be transformed or translated into musical forms which aren't specifically about being youthful. And I tend to think that's where the problem of the labels rock and pop get terribly confused. In as far as rock is associated with youth music, then kind of adult rock becomes an almost contradictory term. Mm-hmm. And that we need to have a wider sense of a kind of popular music which has which plays a part in people's lives as adults in the same way that rock plays a part in people's lives as adolescents.
In one of your essays, you describe how when you went to college, and you went to college at Berkeley in the States,
right?
That when you went to college, you thought, well, time to grow up, get responsible, start listening to less rock music, change your ways.
Yes, that was actually the college. Well, that description is really a description of going to college in England, where I went before I went to Berkeley. So it was very much in the English mid-60s, particularly partly to do with the British class system and so on. You always felt, you know, going to university meant your entry into high culture and low cultural things would be put aside. I think when I got to Berkeley, it was actually that, which was again partly to do with American culture being very different. There, that was rather different. I don't think anybody really had that sense of putting youthful things aside, well, particularly not in 1967, which is when I went there.
So that changed your thinking?
I think it didn't so much change my thinking, but realised that my thinking could actually not feel odd or not feel marginal, that in fact there was a culture in which it made sense.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is British rock critic and sociologist Simon Frith, who has a few new books out. His book Music for Pleasure is a collection of his rock criticism pieces and also some sociological studies as well. And his new book Art into Pop is a study of how the art schools in England have affected rock music. He writes the Britbeat column in the Village Voice, where he covers the British music scene, and he also teaches at a university in Scotland now. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Simon Frith is my guest, and I should mention that he's also been a rock critic for the London Sunday Times and The Observer. Well, we're talking about if rock is still youth music at all, and it makes me think about how a lot of people relate to rock as the music that they grew up with.
Right.
And that whatever they liked from the ages of, say, 8 till 22 is the music that they still like, and that everything else either they don't know about or aren't very interested in.
Right. I think, interestingly, if you look at other musics, it seems to be it's not just to do with rock. That for my parents' generation, the music that they listened to between the ages of 12 and 22, in terms of popular music, still seems to be the music they most like.
Is that a phenomenon that interests you and that you could explain in any way?
I think it certainly interests me. I'm not sure that I can explain it very well. I mean, clearly, there's an obvious response. I mean, an obvious way of thinking about it is music has a part in people's lives during that age in a way that it doesn't otherwise. And I think it's partly because to use a lot of clichés, people are in much more emotional turbulence, to put it like that. They're changing, they're getting involved and having to handle new sorts of feelings, moving away from people, moving close to other people and so on. And in lives that are just sufficiently disrupted, music does have a very powerful emotional force. And it's one way in which people handle their emotions is through identifying with certain sorts of songs or placing themselves according to certain sorts of singers' voices and so on. And the classic English expression is that people, once they get married, settle down. And that kind of settling down process does imply a sense in which there won't be those sorts of disruptive emotions anymore, and music no longer has the same need. So I think there is a way in which you could say, because of music's emotional force, it tends to be attached or associated with people at the times of their lives when they felt most emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's an interesting program on British radio where people are asked to call in and request a piece of music which means particular, you know, a great amount to them. And I think when the program started, it was assumed that people would call in and say, when I first met my husband, the song that was playing on the jukebox was. But in fact, by now, that program, which does a kind of spot every morning, every morning during the week at 11 o'clock, in virtually all the cases, what they're actually describing is fantastically huge emotional crises in their lives. And that's when the music has seemed to matter most to them, you know. So it's not about meeting your first husband, it's about having to have an abortion or having one's mother killed. I mean, it's kind of like a ghoulish program to listen to.
Do you find that music means something different to you now than it did when you were 18?
I think it probably... It doesn't. I still find music, particular songs, obsessing me, and they still do tie in with particular feelings or emotions or kind of emotional needs I have listening to them. But because I'm older and I have very different sorts of emotions now than when I was 18, I probably listen to different sorts of music. But I think it still means the same amount to me.
I want to bring up something, an issue that you raise in Music for Pleasure, one of your new books. You write that the pop critical rule of thumb has always been that black musicians are by definition better, more authentic, more soulful, more expressive, more real than white musicians. You're challenging that.
Yes, I'm saying that that's kind of an assumption that no one sits down and works out why they think that. I mean, again...
That's the kind of myth you want to challenge?
Yeah. I mean, in particular, it's a very powerful myth in Britain, probably more... I mean, one of the things you have to remember is that for British pop and rock fans, it's a very odd thing that all the music that we listen to is essentially at root Afro-American or Afro-Caribbean. It is not British music. And therefore, it already comes to us as a certain sort of exotic status, a certain sense of being a music that is not quite our music. So that even though British bands have been very successful playing that music, it's still been, in some sense, at some level, the Rolling Stones trying to pretend they were black, trying to be rhythm and blues singers. It was the Beatles trying to copy Motown music, trying to tie in with a particular myth of America. And within that myth of America, the myth of black America is incredibly powerful. And I, you know, one of the essays in the book, I trace it right back to, in fact, through British responses to jazz and even to 19th century British responses to to minstrels and so on.
But if you're talking about white bands trying to copy black bands, that would seem to support the statement that the black music is more authentic.
Well, it's because they're trying to copy it that they think it's... I mean, it's authentic in the sense that it's black music and it's white musicians trying to copy black musicians. But I think what then happens is an illogical jump which says somehow black musicians play without any art. You know, somehow this is natural, spontaneous feeling. This is the way they are. And, you know, authentic in terms of a musical judgment becomes authentic in terms of a kind of emotional or judgment of the spontaneity of the music.
This is a myth you're trying to challenge. Why is it important to you to challenge it?
I think partly because I think it makes, it has made in Britain for a peculiar sort of inverted or sometimes straightforward racism, which means that that the world does get split into kind of white music, which has certain sort of art values, and black music, which has certain sort of natural or folk values. And it means that you miss, as a result of that, people misunderstand certain aspects of how black music works in terms of how it works musically, how it works politically, and so on. And there are always moments in British pop culture where white pop music is regarded as superior to black pop music, and particular sort of hatred of Motown music at one time, of reggae, of disco, and so on. All those musics are being dismissed as being all the same, as being somehow kind of primitive dance music, and then contrasted to certain moments, progressive rock or post-punk experimental music or whatever. So, I mean, that's a tendency in British pop criticism which I've always disliked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it needs challenging.
We also write about the suburbanization of rock, and I think the first thing I should ask you to do is explain what you mean by that.
Again, one of the great myths, and this is to do with the way in which British class arguments worked, it was always assumed that rock music, pop music, because they were mass musical forms, were essentially the music of the working class, and that the middle classes listened to a higher grade of music, you know, listened to essentially to classical music, and therefore rock and roll in particular was identified with being the music of working class kids on the streets, and that was very much the myth that was associated with it, associated with particular sort of gangs and fighting and so on and so on. But if you actually look at the history of British pop music and who musicians are, they almost much more dramatically came from the suburbs, not from the inner cities, not from the slums, not from the places which are poor, but from the suburban parts of cities where, in fact, people are in employment, have nice housing, and which is as a way of life which is much more revolving around boredom rather than around violence or around destitution. And that British pop music has always really been about that sort of culture rather than the city culture, which is its myth.
Do you think that the suburban rockers had to pose as urban?
Yes,
rockers?
And I think one of the reasons why their music was so powerful was because they had such an intense fantasy of being urban, of dressing up, and therefore that went into the music. I mean, the Stones, again, are a wonderful example of that. I mean, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards are acting out a great fantasy of being hip, you know, tough kids, which is not what they were in themselves.
What I find interesting about that is to describe the Stones as acting out a fantasy. I mean, everybody else who was growing up was trying to be the Stones because
exactly.
They thought the Stones was the real thing.
Exactly. Well, that's what makes... that's the peculiarity of this, of rock music is so fascinating, in a sense, is this strange way in which which British musicians had a fantasy of America which they tried to live out. And that then came back into America as a kind of reality which American bands then tried to live out that fantasy. So it becomes an extraordinarily circular process.
You write that when you were young, when you were a child, you lived in dread of singing in public, of being asked to sing in public.
Right.
Did you ever go through a period of really wanting to be a rock performer?
No, never. The only thing I ever wanted to be was a disc jockey. Because I think I've always, from when I was very young, what I most liked doing was not wanting myself. I didn't have anything I wanted to say from my own, you know, in terms of my own music. I felt that everything I wanted to say was said for me by other musicians on records, and I just had this great urge to make people sit down and listen to this record because I loved it. I must have driven my parents mad.
You didn't play things for them, did you?
I would say, I remember buying Little Richard when I was very little and saying, listen to this record, isn't it fantastic? And everybody carefully leaving the room. So that's always what, I mean, I've always, and I think most good critics are actually more like that than they're wanting to be musicians, because what they want to do is share the effect that music has on them and, you know, to persuade people to listen to things they might not otherwise listen, to talk about what they're hearing and so on.
So what are you listening to now that you find really exciting, not because of what it's doing socially, but just because of how it speaks to you?
I suppose two rather contrasting forms. On the one hand, I think hip-hop, and particularly New York-based hip-hop, is certainly the most exciting musical form of the 1980s. And one of the most fascinating things about it is a form which seemed, when it started, by definition, to somehow be limited, both formally, but also because the sense that if this music took off, it would be absorbed somehow into a kind of mainstream music.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem to have happened. It does seem that hip-hop, I'm not really thinking in terms of the kind of politics of its lyrics, but in terms of the way it's developed certain sorts of sound effects, certain sort of kind of studio techniques, use of rhythm tracks and so on, remains an extraordinarily exciting form where you're never quite sure that another new record isn't about to arrive and completely knock you over. And the combination of being music both for dancing and having a certain sort of, I don't know, menacing quality in artistic terms of a kind of disruption of the way in which music is usually put together, that still excites me very much. And I think it's a very interesting phenomenon how hip-hop is. I mean, it is strange to go to European countries like Holland or Sweden and find that there's a basic hip-hop subcultures of kids who are all trying to sound like New Yorkers, you know, rapping on the street corners and so on.
What's the second thing you're listening to?
And the other thing, which is completely opposite, is what in Britain will be called Europop, which is the kind of pop music which is what happens to certain sorts of particularly kind of disco and funk type music when it's absorbed, when it's mediated via European, French, German, Italian, much more sort of slushy club values. And one of the things that's most interesting about being in Britain at the moment is there's a way in which, having for many years, Britain always looked in musical terms to America, and there being a kind of Anglo-American music which then dominated the world, and which other European countries, you know, bought in on certain sorts of ways, but never had any sense that they would make music equivalent. There are ways in which I think now Britain is becoming part of a European pop culture, which is beginning to differentiate it from American pop culture. So that I think, for example, now the average British teenager would immediately feel comfortable in any club or record store in a European town in a way that they wouldn't in an American town. There's a kind of cultural difference. The dominance of rock and certain sort of basic rock forms is much stronger in the States than it is in Britain.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Simon Frith's new book, Music for Pleasure, Essays in the Sociology of Pop, is published by Routledge. He also co-authored the new book, Art into Pop, about the British art schools and the rock music scene, and that's published by Methuen. Frith writes the Britbeat column about the British music scene in the Village Voice, and he's also the director of a center for research in film, television, and music at the universities of Glasgow and Strathclyde in Scotland. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with former New York Times reporter Neil Sheehan. His new book, A Bright Shining Lie, looks at the Vietnam War through the experience of Lieutenant Colonel John Paul Vann, a disillusioned soldier who spoke out against the corruption and brutality of the U.S. military system, but remained obsessed with winning the war. I hope you can join us.
This is where you got it from. Anybody who's down with the hip-hop scene and believe they know the music and what it means, all the different DJs and the way they cut. If you don't, listen up. A whole lot of DJs said they're ready to go for some unapparent reason. Ask me, I'll never know before the music is over and the record is done. You DJs will know this is where you...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Octavio Paz is a Mexican poet, essayist, and former diplomat. He's one of Latin America's foremost intellectuals. Coming up, he talks about the impact of revolution, surrealism, and history on his work. Also, we introduce our new performer in residence, pianist Harry Connick Jr. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Gorillas in the Mist. Laurie says the new movie about murdered naturalist Diane Fossey carries an important message for these times. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Senate gave overwhelming approval today to an election year drug bill that funds law enforcement programs, gives money for treatment, and calls for the death penalty to drug traffickers who kill. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
By a margin of 88-2, senators eagerly approved the drug bill so as to give the voters back home the impression that something is being done in Washington about the problem of illegal drugs and their abuse. The measure calls for $2.6 billion worth of additional funding for law enforcement agencies and for drug abuse treatment and education programs. The catch, however, is that only $450 million has been made available to actually pay for these programs, and lawmakers will be hard-pressed to find more money because of budget restraints. The measure institutes the death penalty for drug kingpins who kill civilians or law enforcement officers. It establishes a cabinet-level czar to coordinate national drug abuse policy, and it extends mandatory drug testing to transportation industry workers and federal parolees. The House has already approved a harsher version of the drug bill, and the two bodies will attempt to reconcile their differences next week. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Michael Dukakis campaigned on the West Coast today. His political organization refused to claim that viewers preferred George Bush's performance in last night's presidential debate. NPR's Jim Angle reports.
Governor Dukakis has declined to say much to reporters about last night's debate. In a speech in Sacramento today, he said the Republicans have now been at bat three times in the debates, but struck out. His wife, Kitty Dukakis, answered questions from reporters, and she denied he lost last night's debate.
I don't at all. Our focus polls show that Michael won that debate. And those are the polls in a few days' time that are going to show us very close, but growing, as we have been these last weeks. And I'm feeling very good, as is the governor.
Governor Dukakis did tell reporters as he boarded a plane in Los Angeles this morning that it was a good night last night. We're moving forward, he said. We've got 25 good days to win this election. I'm Jim Angle with the Dukakis campaign in Sacramento, California.
Two Native Americans who admitted taking hostages at a local newspaper in Robeson County, North Carolina, were acquitted today of all charges. Eddie Hatcher and Timothy Jacobs, both of Pembroke, North Carolina, told the jury that they took over the newspaper office to protest local corruption. The two held as many as 20 people hostage during the 10-hour siege last February. The South African government today set up a high-level task force to investigate the growing number of unsolved cases of right-wing attacks on church and trade union buildings. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Minister of Law and Order Adrian Flock today denied charges that the police do not investigate attacks on anti-apartheid institutions as vigorously as attacks by government opponents. But he conceded that the police have not solved a series of major attacks on church and union buildings. Under criticism from local and international religious and labor leaders, Flock announced that a new task force will try to find the offenders. Dozens of buildings containing anti-government offices have been attacked. The National Union headquarters and the National Council of Churches headquarters were destroyed by the largest bombs ever used in South Africa. The latest attack came this week when fire gutted the national headquarters of the Catholic Bishops' Conference. Several bombs were found in a closet. Today, the Catholic Bishops' Conference accused the police and state television of deliberately trying to create the false impression that church leaders allowed bombs to be kept there. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
Stock prices were fractionally lower in moderate trading on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 2133.18. Advances and declines were about even on volume of 161 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
Whenever you're ready, man.
And with that, we introduce our new performer-in-residence, Harry Connick Jr. Over the next several weeks, he'll play his blend of traditional and modern piano styles, putting some new spins on old tunes. At 21 years old, Harry Connick Jr. is creating a stir on the national jazz scene. The Connick name is already well-known in his native New Orleans, where his father is the district attorney. Harry Connick Jr. credits his dad for his early musical inspiration.
My dad always tells me new songs to play. He's a big music lover, and he knows probably every standard jazz song and big band song that there is to know. And one song that he showed me when I was a little kid was When You're Smiling. And it was a funny story. When I was at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, I surprised everyone in the audience by saying that there was a special guest in the house who was going to come up and sing with me. And my dad came up on the stage and sang this tune with me. And I wish he was here to sing it today, but maybe he would steal the show and I would never be able to get back on NPR again. So anyway, When You're Smiling. When you're smiling, darling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, when you're laughing, that sun comes shining through. Oh, but when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your crying and get happy again. 'Cause when you're smiling, or when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. Smiling, the whole world was smiling at my pop up there on the stage, sounding like Frank Sinatra with his microphone and doing his little dance. Yeah, he was something else that day. One of the tunes I used to play in New Orleans is another tune. I should dedicate this while I'm on the subject of my father to him, because I love him no greater than anyone. You know what I'm trying to say. I love him a lot, and there is no greater love than my pop. Thank you.
Harry Connick Jr.'s first album is titled Harry Connick Jr., and it's on Columbia Records. He has a new album coming out later this month. He'll be back with us next week. This is Fresh Air. Octavio Paz is one of Mexico's leading writers and intellectuals, as well as a former diplomat. Yale professor Roberto González Echevarría wrote of Paz that he's such a masterly presence in the dialogue of Latin American culture that it's easy to forget that he's first and foremost a poet. Paz was born in 1914 of mixed Spanish and Indian descent. His grandfather was a journalist. His father was a lawyer who fought in the Mexican Revolution and served revolutionary leader Emiliano Zapata as a diplomatic envoy in the U.S. Many of Paz's essays are meditations on Mexican history and identity. His 1950 book, The Labyrinth of Solitude, is considered a classic in Latin American literature. In it, Paz wrote, "To become aware of our history is to become aware of our singularity." Paz has published more than 40 volumes of poetry and prose. His new book, Sor Juana, is the story of one of Mexico's great poets, a 17th century nun who wrote in Latin, Spanish, and Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs. Paz says Sor Juana's life mirrors his own and that he sees in her mind the destiny of the Mexican intellectuals of today.
I believe very much in that the poet has the subject, the real subject of the poet is time, one moment of time. But this time in our period of history is linked with public life. I don't want to make public poetry, but I try to find the poetry of always through the speciality, through the special events of our time.
It seems to me that you look to history to understand yourself and the things around you in the way that some people might turn to psychology.
Well, in some way, I think history is much more powerful than psychology. Psychology has to do with individuals, but history has to do with society, and you can understand better one person through the collectivity, through the spirit of a time.
You went to Spain during the Spanish Civil War. Did you go there to fight?
Well, I wanted to fight. I went to a Congress of Writers, anti-fascist writers, and I tried to enroll in, but I was not accepted. Perhaps it was a fortune. And then I stayed for some months in Spain, went back to Mexico to make some propaganda work for the Spanish Republicans.
Shortly after you were in Spain during the Civil War, you moved to France. And there you became, I think, part of a circle of surrealist painters and artists. And I was wondering if surrealism seemed artistically revolutionary to you at the time.
And yes, it was, you know, it was not only in the artistic sense, but in a deep way, surrealism was profoundly subversive, and in this sense, I was very much interested in surrealism. Many years, some years ago, talking with Luis Buñuel, who was a good friend of mine, he asked me, why did you become a friend of the surrealist? I said, I think for the same reasons that you, for moral reasons more than artistic reasons.
Well, if you found surrealism morally subversive, what kinds of things did it challenge for you in your own thinking?
Well, you know, the authority, the faith in authority, in surrealism I love especially the love of freedom and the love of love. The affirmation that love, eroticism, is a force, a power who can change life. And also, surrealism is not only above reality, I should say, but the other side of the reality, the hidden side that is sometimes terrible and sometimes marvelous, but always surprises us.
You were telling us that surrealism seemed morally subversive and that for you it helped you challenge any faith in authority. It seems to me in your life you've really managed, however, to keep some kind of balance between history and art, between poetry and politics.
Yes, in some way. You know, politics for me has not been central, but I think we are condemned to politics as the medieval men were condemned to church life or to monarchy.
You have served your country as a diplomat as well as a poet and intellectual. And it seems to me that intellectuals in many Latin American countries are taken more seriously by their governments than, say, intellectuals and poets in America are. I mean, you've been a diplomat. Carlos Fuentes has been a diplomat. I can't think of many many congruent examples in America of poets.
Yes, it's true, not too many. Well, the American society also is bigger, is much more complex than Latin American societies. I guess we are sometimes, we have collaborated with the government because there were not many people to fulfill this kind of missions.
Do you think intellectuals are taken more seriously in Latin America?
Yes, in some way, yes. I think one of the saddest things of the American scene now is that intellectuals have not the place that they should have. I think that's a great loss because, after all, in this country you have a very rich literature, great writers, and also great scientists. And I think all these people should have a saying in the public affairs.
I feel the need to bring this up only because it has been written about in the American press. The New York Times recently, in their book review section, had a front page piece talking about a conflict between you and Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes about conflict pertaining to professional rivalry and political differences. And I wonder if you cared to comment on that. And
Well, no, I don't want to comment because I have nothing to say really about it. But it's a misunderstanding. I don't have any. I have a great friendship with Carlos Fuentes. He's a writer that I helped when he started to write. He's a good friend of mine. I think he's a very good novelist. Of course, we don't have the same political ideas in many aspects, and we have difference.
I haven't asked you to read any of your poems because I've been told that you don't like to read your poems in English because you don't like to read the translations.
Well, I love the translations of some of my poems. I think they have been very well translated. I have been very fortunate. But I will not. If a poem is a matter of language, and if you read badly, as I will do, I will destroy the poem. It will be a kind of suicide.
Like, what did you say, like a suicide?
Yes, against my own poetry. Uh-huh. And again, yes.
But you have no problem with the way they've been translated.
Well, sometimes, you know, a translation is never a real... It's another thing. When you translate one poem from one language to another language, you change the poem, and that is good, because you cannot translate exactly. You cannot produce an identical poem. Always is an approximation, and in the best case, is a recreation.
We also talked at the beginning of this interview about history and its importance in your writing. And, you know, a lot of people in America, when they think of history, have gone back to trace their own family history, their family roots. And I wonder if that's been of any interest to you in your pursuit of history, or if you're more interested in the culture and the national identity of Mexico than you are in the specifics of your own personal lineage.
Well, it's always a mix. I am, in some way, a Mexican, born in Mexico, but on the other hand, I am a man of the 20th century, and I try to unite both things. And in family life, is the same thing. I am the son of my mother and my father and my grandfather, etc., a family that in Mexico comes from the 16th century. But on the other hand, I am a man of everywhere. I belong to many places. I live in New York for years and then in Paris and in the Orient. And And then I think we belong, we have two loyalties, the loyalty to our country and the loyalty of our time. And we must try to understand both if you want to make something personal, something creative with this heritage.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I was very pleased to hear you.
Octavio Paz is a Mexican writer and poet. His new book, Sor Juana, is published by Harvard University Press. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Are you doing a postmortem on last night's debate?
Yes, we are. And we talked to Linda Wertheimer about the debate and about what's next for the candidates. It seems like there's plenty of time left before the election to change things, to put out the message, but there may not be another big opportunity for Dukakis to catch up. Also, a look at a major battleground of this campaign, Texas. Dukakis and Benson are sliding in Texas, and it's an important state, because Bush's negative advertising seems to be quite effective there. And we're due a report tonight on Trixie's Cafe. That's a restaurant in Manhattan, which is run as a house party.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic-at-large Laurie Stone just saw the film Gorillas in the Mist. Sigourney Weaver stars as naturalist Diane Fossey, who spent 18 years in Rwanda studying, befriending, and protecting the dwindling population of Africa's rare mountain gorilla. Laurie found the story and Weaver's performance inspiring.
Gorillas in the Mist, about naturalist Diane Fossey, is sketchy about Fossey's psychology and thin on the politics of Rwanda, the small African country where she ferociously protected mountain gorillas. But from the first moments of this film, I was moved. Ian Cuthbertson, who plays Louis Leakey, tells a Louisville assembly about the systematic destruction of the animals. Native poachers hunt and kill them, cutting off their heads and hands to sell abroad as souvenirs. Poachers wipe out a whole gorilla family to capture a single baby, which is then sold to a European zoo. Leakey shows slides of the majestic animals, their coats velvety black, their intelligent heads crowned by ridges of thick fur. There are only a few hundred left, he says. Then the camera shifts to a woman in the audience, to her jaw. It's the mandible of Sigourney Weaver, who plays Fossey, and that jaw is set, already filled with fury, a primal identification with creatures whose beauty and strength can't protect them from injustice. That rage is immediately recognizable. It's the memory of infant humiliation, the awareness of abused children and rape. Weaver needs little more than her jaw for this part, and using it, she inhabits Fossey's obsessions admirably, convincingly. In Alien, she played the first female movie hero, the first woman to vanquish a villain without the aid of men. In Gorillas in the Mist, we see her gripped by passion. As soon as Fossey encounters the gorillas, she falls in love. The scenes of actual gorillas are mesmerizing. The animals are enormous, averaging 400 and 500 pounds when fully grown. They are so strong they can hurl huge tree trunks yards into the air, but mostly they are peaceful. They sit amid low vegetation, chomping leaves and grooming one another's hair. They beat their chests for pleasure and touch one another often. They are the creatures Rousseau painted, mysterious, alert, soulful. When Weaver earns their trust and huddles with them, chattering, holding their hands, she conveys utterly the delight of interspecies communion. The film traces the 18 years Diane Fossey spent protecting the gorillas from extinction. We see her securing aid from the Rwandan government and curbing slaughter. We also see her slowly deteriorating physically and mentally. She won't leave her mountain, even for part of the year, to share a life with the National Geographic photographer Bob Campbell, played by Brian Brown, who made her known to the world and with whom she had a love affair. She shoots at tourists who wander near her camp, and she goes on wild, vengeful rampages against the Batwa tribespeople, who, at the movie's harrowing climax, murder Digit, a great silverback gorilla with whom she feels the deepest rapport. This sequence is excruciating, and in it Fossey becomes a figure of tragic dimension, thwarted by circumstances, each with a logic but all conspiring against the gorilla's survival. It is a modern reality, fighting a noble fight that drives you to desperate, violent measures. Fosse was brutally murdered in 1985, and the crime remains unsolved. She made many enemies, but her life registers as important. So does this movie. The guerrillas, alive by the thinnest of margins, remind us that the forces of destruction have never been more powerful and that life on this planet has never been more endangered.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I speak with singer Marty Jones. When our rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed her latest album, he praised the deceptive, tentative quality of her voice, which can express passion, guilt, sadness, and sarcasm in one phrase. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has his review of Bird, the new movie based on the life of Charlie Parker, directed by Clint Eastwood. And television critic David Bianculli previews Roseanne, the new ABC comedy series, starring stand-up comic Roseanne Barr. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Piano tuning services are courtesy of the Wilmington Piano Company, and additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton. Production assistance from Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music was composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.